Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today again is Arnie Gundersen, an energy advisor with Fairwinds Associates, a company which provides research, analysis and paralegal services around environmental and energy issues. Arnie is an independent nuclear engineering and safety expert who provides testimony on nuclear operations, reliability, safety and radiation issues to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, congressional and state legislatures, and government agencies and officials throughout the US, Canada, and internationally. He's been a leading voice globally about the impact of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, and he joins us now again. Arnie, welcome.
Hi, Helen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Arnie, I know you're a regular contributor to this program, but you're a very important voice, and people really follow you very closely on Fukushima because you're one of the few people that people can trust and know that you're giving legitimate data. So that's why I keep inviting you back, number one. And number two, because the accident isn't finished. So, Arnie, first, before we go into other details, what about giving us an update on what's happening in Fukushima at the reactors and also the Daiichi reactor south of Fukushima too?
Okay. Well, if you if the role is I have to keep on your show until the accident is over, I think we'll both be dead by then. So it's going to be a long time before
like
the accident is over.
30 or 40 years, I'll be 120.
But to answer your question, here it is the middle of the winter, and it's been quite cold, about 7 below Celsius, which is 17 Fahrenheit. In the last 3 days, there's been about 18 pipes that have sprung leaks.
Really?
Because they're cold. Oh. These pipes were thrown down in a hurry, and they didn't have time to insulate them. And so now we're having pipe leaks, and the spent fuel pool cooling system on Unit 4 had to be shut down for a couple hours while they fix the pipe leaks and things like that. Now, they're going to insulate the pipes to prevent them from freezing, and the insulation will be in by the spring. So that's a little bit late, but over the years, the pipes will finally be insulated. The leaks were in numerous systems, and they were radioactive onto the ground. I don't know that they've gone directly into the ocean, but they're onto the ground. So that's the most recent physical thing. But there's a couple other things that have come out. One was a scientific study that says that when you add salt water to hot nuclear fuel, you change the uranium chemically. It's still uranium, it's still radioactive, but you change it chemically, and it makes it much more soluble in water, which is not a good thing. Now, of course, we all know that the molten core was cooled with seawater, and these scientists who wrote it are very concerned that now we've got uranium in a form that will stay dissolved in seawater for decades, if not centuries, because it's chemically such that it won't plate out. So, that's a concern also. There's a lot of construction activity on Unit 4, taking down the walls and things like that, because they're structurally not sound. And that's still, my big concern still remains that if there's a significant earthquake, and significant means like 7.75, that building can still collapse. Now, a prominent scientist just came out and said there's a 70% chance of an earthquake of that magnitude this year.
Oh.
And there's a 98% chance of an earthquake of that magnitude in the next 3 years. So, you know, that that Unit 4 is critical to get shored up and resolved, because there's no containment whatsoever around the around the nuclear fuel. And finally, the other two units, Unit 2, they drilled a hole in the side of the containment and sent a little camera in. And you really don't see much, but it's high, high humidity, which you'd expect because the nuclear core is not inside the nuclear reactor. It's on the floor. So all of that heat is creating steam. And it looked like a sort of a scene from the movie Alien. Everything was kind of dripping and oozing. And Unit 3 is still off bounds to anybody. There's no, there doesn't appear to be any significant efforts in it. Still water in the on site. Still leaks. My concern there is the leakage into the groundwater, and of course that once it's in the groundwater, it's not coming out for hundreds of years. So, you know, it's precariously stable. And I talk about that in the video we put out right at the turn of the year, where as long as nothing really bad happens, it'll hang together. But you know, something like another earthquake or a hydrogen explosion inside of one of the containments could pop all this up to the surface again. And lastly, there was an earthquake right at January 1st. It wasn't huge. It was better than a 6, so it's certainly very significant. But all at once afterward, the cesium concentrations went up pretty much all over Japan. And what they figure now is that a lot of that stuff that's lying on the ground got shaken up as dust and re-volatilized again. And, of course, that concern is going to be with us for years to come.
Now, Ani, TEPCO and the Japanese government say they have cold shutdown. Can you explain to the audience in the three molten reactors why that is not so? And what is cold shutdown?
Cold shutdown in the nuclear industry means that the nuclear core is below boiling, 200 Fahrenheit, about 90, 95 Celsius. But it also means that the nuclear core is actually inside the nuclear reactor. And that means that all of the nuclear fuel is quite cool. Even the center of the fuel is quite cool. Remember, the fuel is about the thickness of a pinky. And if the outside's at 90 Celsius, the inside's not going to be too hot. But what's happened at Fukushima is that, one, there's no nuclear core in the nuclear reactor. It's all melted down and is on the floor. So the center of that molten mass is much hotter than 212. So it really is a misnomer to call it a cold shutdown, because it's not a closed system. There's a hole in the bottom of it, and the water's leaking out. It's important that they were able to cool the water, but it certainly doesn't represent the stability that the term cold shutdown really means.
In a normally designed, functioning reactor with all its rods in place and the control rods in place and the water circulating, it's just a big molten blob of radioactive lava, isn't it? So to say it's a cold shutdown is crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
And that blob is covered with water.
Yeah.
So the outside of the blob is at, 200 or 300 degrees, but the inside of that blob is still molten and will be for years, because all that decay heat from all those fissions over the years is going to keep that blob hot.
So what would be the
really
temperature?
It's a misnomer.
What would be the temperature inside the blob then?
We're at the point where there's really no science to make that determination. But my guess is something around 1,000 degrees.
Oh, really?
And now that's not molten, for uranium, it has to be about 2,000 to be molten. But 1,000 degrees is, you know, certainly hot enough to fry an egg.
That ain't a cold shutdown. That ain't a cold shutdown. Now, Arnie, the main reason I wanted to interview you were, well, it's several things. I wanted to talk about the cedar flowers and I wanted to talk about the grasshoppers. Do you want to talk about that, those issues?
Yeah, the cedar flowers are a major concern. Most of Japan's mountains have cedar trees planted on them, and they've discovered that the tips of these new buds, and of course it's winter there, so in the spring the cedar flowers will release their pollen, but the tips of those buds not only have pollen in it, but they're loaded with cesium, to the tune of about a quarter of a million disintegrations per second for every kilogram of buds that are out there. So the analysis shows that these cedar trees will, you know, open up in the spring and release their pollen. These are the male buds, not the female buds. They'll release their pollen and they'll release cesium. There's lots of assumptions in the calculation, and none of them are very are concerned about protecting the population. But the calculations show that the people exposed will be getting about 10 times what people in Tokyo will be getting. Frankly, I wouldn't surprise me if the people in Fukushima Prefecture get 100 times background for a period of a couple months, while all these cedar buds are spewing forth the cesium. The concern is twofold. One is obviously the inhalation exposure, and the second is now you've revolatilized cesium. So where you think it's clean, it's going to be dirty again, and they're going to have to go back in and decontaminate areas because of cesium deposition.
So the trees are sucking up through their roots cesium that's dissolved in the water, and then it's bioconcentrating in the pollen in the buds, right?
That's absolutely right. And that's not going to stop this year. No, the same cycle is going to happen next year and the year after.
Cesium lasts for 600 years, or some say
right.
300, but, you know, 300 to 600. We're talking about time frames that one can hardly imagine. What's the geographical distribution, Arnie Gunderson, of the cesium-laden trees?
Well, I know that 70% of Fukushima Prefecture is forest. To give your listeners an idea, Fukushima Prefecture is roughly the size of the state of Connecticut. In the states here, it's not a large state, but it's still, you know, thousands of square kilometers is contaminated. So the Japanese are planning over time to take 5 centimeters of soil off of everything, off of the entire prefecture, and to prevent the further spread of cesium.
But that won't stop the trees sucking it up from the underground water system.
No, you're absolutely right, Helen.
Go on.
Once the trees suck it up, it's going to be on top again because it's going to come out with the buds.
And where are they going to put this 6 centimeters of soil, I ask you?
That's really
radioactive
important.
Waste.
Yeah, that's really important because they are not treating it as radioactive waste.
What
the rule is in Japan is they are incinerating anything radioactive as long as the ash stays below 4,000 disintegrations per second in a kilogram of material. Now, what they do to meet that goal is, let's say you've got something highly, highly contaminated. What they do to meet that goal is they take a whole bunch of clean material and burn the clean material so that the concentration at the end stays below this 4,000. Rather than treat it as radioactive waste and keep it in concentrated form, they are in fact creating 100 to 1,000 times more radioactive material in an effort to drop the concentration down. But you and I know that, you know, you're just spreading a contagion. It's not like you're eliminating it. Now you've got more material to dispose of over a much larger area. So a lot of it is going into landfills, which, of course, will then get into the groundwater and et cetera. Tokyo Bay is also another landfill that's accepting radioactive cesium. And they are seeing radioactive cesium in the water in Tokyo Bay now.
Yeah, but you're talking about incineration and only the radiation left in the ash. But you haven't mentioned that the fact when you incinerate stuff, it goes up the chimney, out into the air, and they're spreading, dispersing radioactive materials throughout the air in Japan through this incineration.
Well, and the incinerators, there are modern incinerators that would trap a lot of that gases that go up. They really need things called electrostatic precipitators and bag houses to capture it all. But very few of the incinerators that are in use right now are using those devices. So we're seeing radioactivity go up these stacks and also get concentrated in the air. So either way, it's not a good thing.
Now, so that's only cesium, but Arnie, you and I know that not just cesium got out, but a whole slew of other radioactive elements got out, but they only measure cesium. What about all the rest?
Yeah, there's that's really important. Dr. Saji, who used to work for the regulator, now he's a retired independent consultant, just finished some calculations on the airborne gases that left the reactor in the first day or two. And it's not iodine-131 that he was tracking. He was tracking iodine-133, which is a much bigger health concern, but it's got like a two-day half-life. So it disappears in a week or two. So nobody had a chance to check it. But when the kids absorbed it into their thyroid, it likely was a major contributor to thyroid dose that went totally undetected by the system, because by the time the authorities got around to looking, it was gone. Mm. And he said he was appalled by the calculations that he did that indicate very high thyroid doses from 133 iodine. Then there was the xenon and krypton cloud, and those concentrations over the United States were 40,000 times higher than normal. So God knows what they were like over the Fukushima prefecture. And we talked about that, I think, two shows ago, where, you know, the xenon and krypton gases are fat soluble and decay away in a relatively short period of time. But when they do decay away, they do a lot of cellular damage. All of those exposures, the iodine, xenon and the krypton exposures are neglected in any of the calculations the Japanese are doing, because it was gone by the time they got to the scene of the crime.
Yes, and xenon decays not away, it decays to cesium, and krypton decays to strontium.
Yes, which brings you to your other question about I just answered half of that, which is your short-lived ones that nobody was paying attention to. But the long-lived ones, like your strontiums, and oh my God, there's an alphabet soup of other radioactive material out there, including you know, plutonium and americium and uranium. All of those remain in the environment on the surfaces and are much harder to detect than cesium. So you hear about these surveys on cesium, and the reason they're surveying for cesium is it's the easy-to-detect isotope. But all the other ones are lurking there, too, and are not being accounted for.
Why is cesium so easy? Because it gives off a very strong gamma signal?
Yes.
And the other ones are alphas, and it's very, you have to have very special equipment to detect alphas, which are particulates made of two protons and two neutrons, and alphas can be blocked by a sheet of paper. So they're very hard to measure, alpha emitters, and when they get into your body, of course, there's no sheet of paper to block the alpha particle from damaging your chromosome in your cell and causing cancer. Arnie, what's the population of the Fukushima prefecture?
Approximately 4 million people.
4 million people.
And of course, during the evacuation was poorly planned, and a lot of the people were pushed into areas where the plume was actually greater.
Yeah.
So then during the first 3 or 4 days of the accident, people evacuated areas that were not low, but lower, and actually moved into areas that were higher.
Yeah.
And while the Japanese government knew that was happening, they didn't share that with their own population.
Now, they're finding, I think, 3% of children of the few children they've tested in Fukushima province, 3% have thyroid tumors. Is that the accurate number now, Arnie?
The number I heard was 30%.
30%.
They tested 3,000 kids, and more than 1,000 came up with, not tumors, they called them lumps.
Well, let me explain from a medical perspective. If you don't take out the lump, you don't know. Well, you can, by ultrasound, determine if it's a cyst or a solid tumor. To find thyroid lumps in children is extremely, extremely rare. I don't know in my medical practice in pediatrics if I've ever seen one. Maybe I have, just one. So you would have, number one. Number two, the latent period of carcinogenesis, in other words, the time it takes for a thyroid tumor to appear, is very short in this instance. It's only a year. But as children are very, very sensitive to radiation, you may, you know, this is new, I guess, in the history of pediatrics, you may be already seeing thyroid tumors. And to actually know what these lumps are, you need to take them out. Now, a cyst can have cancer cells in it, number one, and the solid tumors, a tumor is just a collection of cells that has grown, probably quite a few of them will be cancers. So do you know what they're doing with these children, these 30% of children that were tested and others that have thyroid lumps, Arnie?
Yeah, well, they're finding them with ultrasonic techniques. They're sending in a sound wave and they're imaging the thyroid.
But are they taking them out?
The lumps are on the order of 5 millimeters.
Yeah.
So now the only thing they're doing right now is just monitoring it.
What do you mean, waiting till the cancer spreads into their bones and they die? I mean, one way you could do it is by a fine needle biopsy. You stick a very fine needle into the lump and you extract some cells and examine them under the microscope. Or if it's a cyst, extract the fluid and look at the cells in the fluid, and then you can make the diagnosis of what this particular pathology is. And without that, if they're just monitoring them and waiting for the thing to spread without knowing histologically or pathologically what these tumors are, that is, I can't tell you how irresponsible that is medically. It's just terrible.
Well, the only piece of good news there is that at least the government is beginning to monitor thyroids on kids. But you're right. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And to see one-third of the kids test positive for lumps in their thyroid. And we're only, 10 months into the accident here. That forebodes some real thyroid issues in the future.
How many people do you think now, through the retrospectoscope, Arnie Gunderson, should have been evacuated from areas they now live in that are too hot to really be occupied?
I think they should have evacuated about 250,000 to 350,000 people. In fact, they moved out about 100,000. So the number of people, and even there, Helen, it's not clear whether they evacuated them because of the tsunami or because of the accident. There's a lot of people on the move in Japan after the accident, in part because their homes were destroyed by the tsunami. Mm. And on top of that, you had the people downwind from the accident. And I think I have been saying this for almost a year now. It's hard to imagine, but Japan is lucky because 80% of the time the wind was blowing offshore.
Mm.
So all these problems we're talking about are only one-fifth of what could have happened if the wind was blowing across the island as opposed to offshore.
Oh, goodness. And now what about other areas apart from Fukushima Prefecture? The wind blew towards the northwest and also blew south. Tokyo's got some very hot areas. How many other people do you think are living in dangerous areas, Arnie?
More than half of the population of Japan are in areas that are contaminated.
More than half.
Yeah. Essentially, you know, if you're even 400 kilometers away, you're seeing contamination. So it's essentially the very southern parts of Japan that are almost radiation free, if you exclude what's in the ocean. I think the long term consequences to the entire coast of Japan will be from coastal contamination from the currents moving up and down the coast. But right now, the airborne seems to have contaminated within 400 kilometers of the site. And what we're seeing, Helen, is a lot of that is now washing out to sea, and we're seeing rivers becoming the sediment in rivers becoming more and more contaminated with cesium far from the accident, because it's going to concentrate as it runs out of the hills. It's going to concentrate in the river sediment, and then the river sediment's going to get eaten by things that then work their way up the food chain. So even in freshwater fish, as far away as a couple hundred kilometers away, we're beginning to see cesium in the tissues of freshwater fish.
And the Japanese love their fish, and they love eels. I love smoked eels in Japan. And they say 63% of the fish caught in the Pacific now around Japan is showing cesium. Is that correct, Arnie Gunderson?
Yes. I don't know too much about it, though, Helen. I'm sorry.
No, but that's what they're saying at Woods Hole and other places. One of the reasons I wanted to interview you so badly this time, Arnie, was that wonderful tape that you put on Fair Winds, your website, to show that little girls, are five times more sensitive to the effects of radiation than little boys. I don't know why that's so, and that because the Japanese government allowed the population to be exposed to 20 millisieverts, which is 2 rems a year, these girls are at great risk of getting cancer. Do you want to talk about that, Arnie?
Yeah. I was aware that Frontline was going to put up a story, and Frontline just took it on face value that that 2 rems or 20 millisieverts was essentially inconsequential.
Did they?
And I went to the National Academy of Sciences biological effects of ionizing radiation report, and it's crystal clear that for the entire population, that means that one out of every 500 people will get a cancer. But that for the number that the Japanese have said, but Frontline didn't dig far enough. But what that means is that's people like you and I, who are, by the time I get a cancer, I'll probably be dead from something else. As you're on your old side of that spectrum, sorry, Helen, we both are.
Yeah.
But when you look at the Beer Report and you look at the other side of the spectrum, it's actually the young girls who are five times more radiosensitive than the population as a whole. So that means one out of 100 young girls, every year they're exposed to this, is going to get a cancer at some point in their life from Fukushima. So if a kid is there for 5 years, you're talking about one out of every 20 young girls.
Oh, my God.
Essentially, if you look at a classroom full of kids, one out of 20 of those kids is going to get a cancer as a result of Fukushima.
And probably when they're relatively young.
Yes, yes. So what the Japanese have done is they look at the broad spectrum and they say, well, one in 500, we've got to suck it up and move forward. But in fact, the numbers are skewed because the burden is placed disproportionately on the very young, who never used the nuclear power in the first place. So the people who use the nuclear power, who are older in the population, are likely to die of something else, and so the risk has been displaced onto the younger people of their population.
Now, I thought there was so much concern and agitation in Japan about that 20 millisievert or 2 rem dose that they have changed the standard to which people can be exposed. Have they changed it, or is it still 20 millisieverts, Arnie?
As far as I know, it's still 20 millisieverts. You know, there's talk of over time lowering the standards, but you know that's a game. They're just the standards were low for all of these materials. So we're talking about this the material that's being placed in landfills. In any other country on the planet, would be considered radioactive waste, and would have to be, you know, monitored in secure facilities for 300 years, and here the Japanese are spreading it out all over their country, so they arbitrarily raise the standards, and then say we comply with standards that are, you know, much higher than any other civilized country in the world would tolerate.
But we're only talking about external gamma radiation, aren't we, Arnie Gunderson? We're not talking about the radioactive elements that are imbibed through eating radioactive food, drinking radioactive tea, and inhaling radioactive air that land in various organs, irradiating small volumes of cells with high doses. Those internal emitters are not being included in the calculation of the 20 millisieverts dose per year. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. This is an external dose. And, you know, my problem, again, with kids, they're going to get it on their shoes. They're going to tie their shoelaces. They're going to put their hands in their mouth. They're going to kick it up in sports or whatever. And it will either get in their lungs or in their GI tract and cause further damage.
That's so much.
We're far from out of the woods on exposure to the most vulnerable people in society. And, you know, pregnant women are even worse. The fetuses are more likely to be at risk.
But so much of the food's radioactive. You know, I've got friends here in Australia who, they go to Japan skiing, and I think the skiing areas, are up in the northwest of Japan where the radiation went?
Yes, they are. You know, they're offering packages, and people still go. What can I say, Helen? I wouldn't ski there. Come to Vermont. There's the lesson.
They take their children there too. And one final question, then I'll let you go because I know you're tired, Arnie. But what do you think long term this is going to do to Japan and to its economic climate?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm working on a report for Greenpeace that has to do with what are the long term issues. You know, Mikhail Gorbachev credits Chernobyl as toppling his government. He said, you know, forget perestroika or any of that. Chernobyl had a bigger effect at toppling communism than did any of these other things. And I think we're seeing that in Japan, too. We're seeing, you know, one government has already collapsed because of Fukushima, and another one is not doing a very good job either. So I think, you know, if I were a politician, I would say, you know, the downside of this is that an accident can destroy the way a country is governed. You know, so the consequences politically, you know, and obviously, you know, physically to the people who are exposed are enormous and ongoing for, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years.
Well, and also their exports, their cars and various stuff that Japan exports, a huge amount of stuff. Some of it is being found to be radioactive, you know, and countries are sending back radioactive cars and the like. So
yeah,
that'll have an impact.
Helen, that's used cars predominantly. You know, like I know Australia gets a lot of used cars from Japan. The Japanese have laws where you can't keep a car but so many miles. So cars that look good and in fact would be run in other countries get shipped to Russia or to Australia. And when those cars are disembarking in Australia, they're radioactive, but nobody's looking for that radiation. In fact, I'm sure that if I were there with a Geiger counter, I could find it in 5 minutes. But the people at the docks have been instructed by their governments not to look.
Well, on that cheery and really happy note, honey, I think we'll end this. I love talking to you because you always have such fresh, interesting information, and I know that our listeners are hungry for your reports, Arnie, as we provide them intermittently about the ongoing tragedy in Japan. And I thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, could I add one thing?
Please do.
I will be in Tokyo on the 18th of February through the 25th of February. Maggie and I were interviewed for a book, and the book is being published on the 17th of February by Shueisha. And it's titled, it's in Japanese only, but it's titled Fukushima Daiichi, The Truth and the Way Forward. And I'll be presenting a plan so that Japan can be have no nuclear power plants and yet still not be pushed back into the ice age or something like that.
Well, it's only got 3 of the 54 operating now. So in truth, Japan can easily operate, it seems, if they tighten their belts with energy efficiency, can easily operate without nuclear power. And therefore, you could extrapolate that situation to America, couldn't you, Arnie?
Yes, and I will be when I'm in Japan.
Oh, super. Well, thanks a lot again, and have a lovely night's sleep. I know you're tired for morning. For me, it's the morning. For you, you've done a big day's work, so sweet dreams, Arnie.
Okay, thank you, Helen.
Thank
Goodbye.
You. Bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Arnie Gunderson, an energy advisor with over 30 years of nuclear power engineering experience in the United States. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. Now you'll hear an excerpt from a speech I gave at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Congress in Berlin on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl in April 2011.
I'm also dedicating this lecture to my friend and sister, Petra Kelly. Petra and I worked almost hand in hand. She did Europe and I did the United States during the 1980s when the threat of nuclear war was impending, when Ronald Reagan said over an open microphone, I've pressed the button, the missile, I'm paraphrasing, missiles have been launched. I met with Reagan in the White House for an hour and a quarter. I established quickly a doctor-patient relationship with him. I held his hand for at least half that time. He knew nothing about nuclear weapons or delivery systems or CIA reports. I just finished my book, Missile Envy, and so I would correct him. He would then get a malar flush, become very anxious, so I had to hold his hand to reassure him. I estimated his IQ to be average 100, but I also came out of the meeting saying I thought he had impending Alzheimer's disease, which indeed he did. He was the commander-in-chief in charge of thousands of hydrogen bombs with a 3-minute decision time whether or not to launch. This is a very sad time in the history of the world. I have often imagined a major nuclear meltdown and have said for many years that that will end the nuclear industry. I never imagined 4 reactors having various stages of meltdowns built on an earthquake fault by a very capable people, the Japanese, and the fuel pools melting as well. I never imagined it. When I first heard about it 4 weeks ago, being a physician, I extrapolated the prognosis. If indeed one or more of those reactors break through the containment and we have another Chernobyl or 2 Chernobyls, That will mean millions of cases of cancer in the Northern Hemisphere. How hard do we work to try and save a child's life who's dying of leukemia or Wilms' tumour? How hard do we work to try and save a woman's life who's dying of metastatic breast cancer? The medical dictum says if we have an incurable disease, the only way and recourse is prevention. The nuclear industry was begun... Well, I've got a fascinating book here. It's called Radioactive. It's about Madame Curie and Pierre Curie. And it's relevant, I think. When they first discovered X-rays, electricity, radio, the telegraph, the X-rays and radioactivity... At the turn of the 20th century, a series of invisible forces were radically transforming daily life. The advances were dazzling. For some time, they blurred the boundary between science and magic. If invisible light could pass through flesh and expose a human skeleton, was it so fantastical to believe in levitation, in telekinesis, in communicating with the dead? And this began a whole spiritualist movement in the mid-19th century, which seduced millions who were promising contact with the divine through ghosts and spirits. So we've always been fascinated with radiation, as was Madame Curie and Pierre Curie. They gave birth to death. Madame Curie died of aplastic anemia induced by radium. Pierre Curie... He was run over by a horse and buggy. Her daughter, she died of leukemia too. We have known since the beginning of the nuclear age that that radiation induces cancer. However, we're in the middle of a huge argument. The problem is the nuclear physicists since the dawn of the nuclear age, and I knew many of them, they were my friends. George Kistiakowsky, who supplied the implosion mechanism for the first A-bomb. Vicky Weisskopf, Philip Morrison, Edward Teller, who I debated, and I beat him. Jerry Wiesner, who was Jack Kennedy's science advisor. Ted Taylor, who developed the suitcase hydrogen bomb. I knew them all. They were racked with guilt because they had helped to vaporise and kill over 200,000 people in a flash of light in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They thought if they could harness atoms for peace, then they could go to their graves relatively not guilty. They all went to their graves guilty. They knew right from the beginning the toxicity of plutonium. In fact, Glenn Seaborg, who developed plutonium-239, spoke about it at the beginning. Plutonium is so toxic that when injected into beagle dogs, there wasn't a dose low enough that didn't give every dog cancer, 10 to the minus 9 grams. It's said that a microgram is definitely carcinogenic, but it may be much lower. Each reactor manufactures 250 kilos of plutonium per year. It's only needed 2.5 kilos to make yourself an atomic bomb. The half-life of plutonium is 24,400 years. It lasts for 250,000 years or more. It is handled like iron by the body. It's an iron analogue. If inhaled, it induces lung cancer. And let me just point out that the nuclear industry is lying. It lies continuously. It talks about permissible doses of radiation. As we all know as physicians, there is no permissible dose of radiation. As we know as physicians, it is background radiation that induced evolution. Advantageous genes survived. Fish developed lungs. Birds developed wings. We, this magnificent species with a huge neocortex, opposing thumbs, standing on our hind legs, evolved. I happen to think we're an evolutionary aberrant. But most mutations are deleterious and induce disease. As we know, we all carry several hundred genes for disease, cystic fibrosis, diabetes, phenylketonuria, inborn errors of metabolism, dwarfism. There are now 2,600 genetic diseases described. Most are recessive. And yet George Monbiot, in his wisdom, accrued over 3 days reading some scientific and medical literature, said that, surprisingly, no genetic abnormalities were seen in the offspring of the Hibakusha at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why not? Because either they were fatal mutations, there were many spontaneous abortions, many children have been born with gross congenital abnormalities, which are almost certainly teratogenic. And this is described in this wonderful book put together by Yablokov, and I can't wait to hear him speak later on, and Nestorenko, two Nestorenkos. Photographs of children with phocomelia, babies were born with anencephaly, cyclops, spina bifida, you name it. There are homes full of children in Belarus and Ukraine, of grossly deformed children. But most mutations are recessive, and it takes up to 20 generations for two recessive genes, i.e. cystic fibrosis, to get together to form a child with that particular disease. George Monbiot and his colleagues know nothing about genetics. Why? Because we have not taught them. The physicists all this time have prevailed since the 1940s in the Manhattan Project. When the physicists from Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore go to Congress, they almost have a Merlin's cap. They're magic. They walk into Congress, a red carpet's laid out in front of them, and the Congress people virtually lie down in front of them metaphorically, because they've harnessed the energy inside the centre of the sun, E equals mc squared, the most enormous energy. What did Einstein say? The splitting, and this is the most profound statement I probably could make today, the splitting of the atom changed everything. All reality, save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. They think of nuclear bombs like they thought of swords and jousting and pistols. They still think like that. The Pentagon talks like that. It's not the Department of Defense, it's the Department of Death. America is spending almost $1 trillion a year on death, and it doesn't have even a free medical care system, because that's socialist or even communist. We are in a very terrible situation, and peaceful nuclear energy arose from these scientists' brains, capturing the heat of splitting the atom to boil water. As Einstein said, nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water. And that's all nuclear power does. But in each reactor is as much the uranium becomes 1 billion times more radioactive when fissioned in the reactor, 1 billion times. 200 new isotopes are made, some with half-lives of seconds, some with billions of years. And the nuclear industry talk about external radiation, background radiation. It used to be 170 millirems a year. Suddenly it's become okay to say it's 350 millirems a year. I said to my colleague Arjun Makajani, how did it suddenly rise and double? He said, oh, they're adding radon to background radiation. Some people live in houses with radon, most do not. No background radiation is safe. It adds already to the numbers of cancers we see now, maybe 30% or more. The Bear Report of the National Academy of Sciences, number 7, said that no radiation is safe, it's cumulative. Yet, everyone gets a dental X-ray once a year. Alice Stewart, she discovered that one X-ray to the pregnant abdomen to the fetus doubles the incidence of leukemia in that child's lifetime. She was shunned by the nuclear industry for years and made fun of. Her data now stands and is accepted with scientific validity. We do not learn in medical school what internal emitters are. I did not learn what gamma radiation was, but I learnt later that it is produced by radioactive isotopes, cesium, strontium, cobalt-60, and we use it in the treatment of cancer. People are confused. Why do we use radiation to treat cancer? We don't explain that radiation kills actively dividing cells. That's why the fetus is thousands of times more radiosensitive than adults. Why babies and children are 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive. We've got X-ray machines at airports to walk through. They're irradiating fetuses. They're irradiating babies. They're irradiating immunocompromised people. This is wicked. And what do we do? Nothing. What did I learn? I was not taught in medical school what an alpha emitter was. I was not taught it was a particulate composed of two protons and two neutrons, which travels not very far. It doesn't penetrate dead layers of epidermis to damage living dermal cells, but it's grossly mutagenic. And it produces high levels of radiation to a very small volume of cells in the lung. Tiny volume. And as radiation decreases with the square of the distance, most cells die, but on the periphery of that volume, cells remain viable and mutate and develop cancer. People do not understand the latent period of carcinogenesis. They think that if you get irradiated, you'll drop dead. Sure. If you get 250 to 500 rems, LD50, half the people will die of acute radiation illness, as the liquidators died and the liquidators at Fukushima are now dying. But to get cancer takes, as we know from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, leukemia 5 to 10 years, solid cancers 15 to 60 years. Do we explain that to the public? Do we tell them that no cancer wears an identifying badge saying it was made by some strontium-90, you ate in a piece of chocolate, Hershey's chocolate, 20 years ago, as Three Mile Island is 15 miles from Hershey's chocolates, and had a major meltdown, and many people were impacted? I didn't learn about, I want to just finish, plutonium iron analog combines with transferrin, transferred to the mediastinal lymph glands where it can cause lymphoma, stored in the liver where it causes liver cancer, goes to the bone marrow for hemoglobin, causes osteogenic sarcoma or leukemia, crosses the placenta which lets nothing pass except iron, where, like thalidomide, it's teratogenic. It has a predilection for testicles and deposits just next to the spermatogonia, the precursors of the sperm, where it induces mutations that will be passed on generation to generation, while if the man is cremated, his smoke goes out the chimney to get into another man's testicles. And so we can see an exponential increase in genetic disease and deformities for the rest of time, called random compulsory genetic engineering. How dare they? And we're not the only species with genes. 30 million other species cohabit the planet with us, all of which have genes, all of which develop congenital deformities and genetic disease and malignancies. I didn't learn about beta radiation, which is given off by radioactive iodine 131. I didn't learn about beta radiation given off by cesium 137. I didn't know what cesium was. It's a potassium analog, ubiquitous in the body, induces brain cancers, rhabdomyosarcomas, rare as hen's teeth. I didn't learn about cobalt-60, which is not a fission product, but an activation product. I wrote about all of this in this book recently, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. People don't understand that internal emitters induce very high doses of radiation. It's not low-dose radiation, it's high dose. High dose. And yet we don't teach them this. And without understanding We have an uninformed population. An informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion, and that's what we did in the 80s. We informed people about the medical implications of nuclear war. Most Americans in 78 said to me, "Oh, it's better to be dead than red." I said, "Really?" They said, "Yeah, we don't want to be communist." So we started doing the bombing run and dropping bombs on Boston and describing the medical implications. Vaporization up to 5 miles, lethal burns up to 20 miles, and they'd wake up in the morning and look at the Boston Globe and say, "Ooh, nuclear war is bad for our health." In 5 years, we educated 80% of Americans to be opposed to the concept of nuclear war. Petra and all of you educated Germany and Europe. The whole world rose up and helped to lead to the end of the Cold War. However, the weapons were not removed. We are living with death machines. Death, which is silent, cryptogenic, latent, takes a long time to develop. Only we, the medical profession, understand cancer. And yet we're not teaching the ordinary people nor the scientifically illiterate politicians what this means, the latent period of carcinogenesis, the toxicity of these fission products. Angela Merkel, yeah, she's a physicist, good. She understands the danger of Fukushima, good. But does she understand the radiobiology? And unless people understand this, we are doomed.
That was an excerpt from a speech I gave in Berlin in April 2011 at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Congress on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl. Thanks for listening today. Look, I know it was emotional. I can't help it. I'm a physician, a pediatrician. How many children have I helped to die with cystic fibrosis, the most common lethal genetic disease of childhood, which will be increased in frequency down the time track by nuclear power, and over 2,000 other such diseases? How many children have I helped to die of leukemia or cancer? It's the most heart-rending experience you could possibly imagine. I'm sorry, I can't help being emotional. And I think indeed, if we're not emotional about these things, there's something wrong with us. And I often use this analogy. If I have two parents in my office and I tell them that their child has just been diagnosed with leukemia and they show no emotional response, I get them a psychiatrist because they need help with their grief. Thanks for listening today. We'll be with you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.